Okay, now it started. The major reason for this is the following. The term of the highest degree, the monomial x to power n, when absolute value of x is large, plays a major role. All the rest are negligible. What does it mean, negligible? One can find such a large number r that when absolute value of x equals to this r, then x to power n, absolute value of x to power n is greater, well, just greater, it would be enough, than the rest, the absolute value of the rest of polynomial. And I'm sure that you heard this in calculus. Indeed, if I divide both sides by the same term, x to power n, on the left-hand side, I will get one. On the right-hand side, I will get something which tends to zero. So when x tends to infinity, this thing becomes less than one. How it looks like in geometry. So we have a plane. On the plane, let us consider such large R, such large area, and look at the image. The image of x to power n, let me write it separately. So this is zero, this is a zero in the image. However, of course, it is the same. But this is a circle of radius r. Now I take a circle of radius r to n. And the image of this circle, as my point goes along this circle, the image of it, x to power n, would go along that circle and would go faster. It would make, while the original point goes around once, the image of this point would go n times. This is about just the power of x. But in my polynomial, there is also that second ingredient. However, it is small. Small means that its absolute value is smaller. So if I place x to power n here, where it is, then adding of this would deviate me from this point by a distance less than the distance to the origin. So while my x goes once around, x to power n goes n times, and this p of x goes along. So it is sort of goes around several times, and it never goes beyond zero. Now, let us consider the image of the whole disk. The image of the whole disk will extend this thing. And it will cover zero. That's basically the proof of this fundamental theorem of algebra. While your point goes, while the image of a circle goes several times around some point, then, and you extend this by a continuous map of the whole disk, the disk will cover the origin and this point, and even several times. That many times as the point went around the circle. Is it clear? Any question about that?
Why does it go through the origin? Or wait, no, sorry. Why does it go through this point?
Look, I take this first disk, and it is mapped by P to the plane. The boundary, how the boundary of the plane, the boundary circle is mapped, I described. It goes n times around the circle. Why it goes n times? Well, because x to power n goes n times. It is very standardly goes around it. So, you know, the argument of complex number when you take nth power is just multiplied by n. So the velocity with which it goes is just n times the velocity of the original point. It goes n times around. After that, I add the rest of P of x. And this does not change the number of times I go around the point. If you like,
why does it matter how many times you go around the point?
Because when I go several times around the point, non-zero times, and then fill this with the map of the disk will cover this point. If the point is not covered, it is sort of broken disk. It is by continuity. So this is the only place where topology is used.
Ah, okay, I see. Okay.
Okay. And I wanted to reproduce this traditional for topology proof because also I want to show that this is a topological property. This is about continuity. We need to use the fact that is belongs to analysis in a sense. Now, there is one more point about fields and algebra, and it belongs to algebra now, not to topology or analysis. This is so-called small Bézout theory. We have now polynomial P of x and some number A. I want to divide this P of x by binomial x minus A. What does it mean divide? I want to represent this P of x as x minus a times some polynomial Q of x plus, well, I cannot guarantee a priori that I can do like this. So what is left will be of degree zero, will be some number. So this is division with remainder. This is the remainder. It is always possible to do it. It can be done as you do division of large numbers. You can apply the same construction. And now, using this presentation, one can deduce that P of A equals zero if and only if P of X really can be divided without any remainder by x minus a. Indeed, if you take this identity, definition of division with remainder, and plug in instead of x a, you will get on the left-hand side P of a. On the right-hand side, you will get, well, the first product will be zero because here is a minus a, and the right-hand side will be r. So from this formula, it follows that P of a equals r. And therefore, P of a equals zero if and only if you can represent it in this way without remain. Then you can do the same with Q of X. So overall, the statement that we come to is that if our field is algebraically closed, then any polynomial in one variable of degree greater than zero can be presented as a product. X minus first root times X minus second root, and so on, times the last root. The degree was n, let it be n. Well, some roots may be repeated twice, and also some constant maybe. So over algebraically closed field, any polynomial in one variable looks like that. And this was used. Not the previous stuff, only this was used in the arguments last time. As for the number of roots, the number of pairwise different roots may be smaller than n, because some of roots may be repeated. They come with multiplicity. Multiplicity is the number of times such that this polynomial is divisible by x minus root to that power. And this will play an important role in what follows. Okay, any question about this?
How do we make sure that the remainder is zero?
Well, I said that remainder is zero if and only if A is the root. And this is what is written here. Okay. If the remainder is zero, then we have this, and plugging in A, we get that P of A equals, well, A minus A is zero, so the right-hand side is zero. On the other hand, if P of A is equal to zero, then you can plug in into the same equality this fact, and you will see that zero equals, again, A minus A is zero, so the first part doesn't matter, zero equals R. And that's it. Other questions? Now, I followed to a large extent what is written in.
Yeah. So, you know, I'll be in trouble in like 40 minutes.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, let me continue. Followed the textbook, and the textbook pretend to be written done right, which means that without determinants, and we have determinants, and it allows to simplify many proofs, in particular those proofs which were given last time. Let me explain this. First of all, we have the following statement that lambda is an eigenvalue if and only if the characteristic polynomial of eigenvalue of the operator T. Here the field doesn't matter. This will happen over any field. So this is true if and only if lambda is the root of the characteristic polynomial. In other words, the determinant of T minus lambda I is zero. Okay. How this happens? Well, if so, lambda is an eigenvalue if and only if, by definition, there exists a non-zero vector from our space. Oops. Here it shouldn't be T, it should be V. Sorry. Such that TU equals lambda U. Okay. Now, this is so if and only if T minus lambda I applied to U equals zero. This means that T minus lambda I is not invertible. So it is not injective. U belongs to the null space of T minus lambda U. So therefore it is not invertible. And this happens if and only if the determinant is equal to zero. So here is the proof. There was different proof in the last lecture. It was more complicated, but it didn't use characteristic polynomial. Let me use for characteristic polynomial a little bit more smaller notation. So the determinant of T minus lambda I will be denoted I for characteristic of, with this index T, which is our operator. And here will be lambda, which is the variable. So this condition means that lambda is, so the condition that we discussed means that lambda is the root of this characteristic polynomial. You know, characteristic polynomial is a polynomial of degree n, where n is the dimension of V. So this is the degree of high T. Okay, and now it follows from here immediately that if F is algebraically closed, then any operator in a finite dimensional space, but non-zero dimensional, there exists, has eigenvalue. So I proved this last time differently. And now we see that the number of eigenvalues, since these are just roots of characteristic polynomials, is at most n. So I wrote this for the number of eigenvalues. For each eigenvalue, we can consider E lambda T. This is the set of all eigenvectors. Which correspond to lambda. So this is a space. It is called eigenspace. Oops, sorry. Eigenvectors. Well, this should be written like this, because V is the first letter for values as well. We know that those eigenspaces form a direct sum. They do not intersect, and moreover, the vectors, non-trivial vectors, which we pick up from each of them, are never linearly dependent. So we have a thing like that. How many summons are there? Well, the number of summons here is not just a dimension of n. It would be nice, but it happens that polynomial may have multiple roots. If it has multiple roots, then the number of pairwise distinct eigenvalues, pairwise distinct roots of characteristic polynomials, is less than the dimension of V. And then it may happen that the sum of the sum is contained in V, but is not V itself. If it was already V, we would be happy because we have analyzed our operator T till very end. It is clear how these summons are organized from the point of view of T. T restricted to this eigenspace is just the identity operator times lambda. So it is very simple. However, there are situations where it is not so, and we are going to discuss this now. Any questions so far?
Professor, so just to clarify, zero is also in the eigenspace?
Excuse me?
Zero is also an element of the eigenspace?
Well, it depends on the, well, of course, zero is an element of eigenspace.
Okay.
There cannot be eigenspace without zero. Should we call zero eigenvector is a difficult question. In the textbook, it is not so. So the definition may be either in a broad way, eigenvector corresponding to eigenvalue is just the solution of equation T V equals lambda V. Or in a narrow sense, when we require also that this is not zero. When we speak about eigenspaces, of course, we have to include the zero, and it creates slight inconvenience because then an element of eigenspace is not eigenvalue vector. But it's okay. In the textbook by Axler, each time when such situation appears, he specifically mentions that, well, this is the set of all eigenvectors corresponding to lambda plus the zero vector, the subspace.
So when there are fewer eigenvalues than the dimension of V, the direct sum might be less than V, or
yes,
just a subset?
Yes. And let me show an example like that. So let us consider matrix 1, 1, 0, 1. The characteristic polynomial is what? It is x squared minus 2x plus 1. What are the roots? The roots are 1. There is only one root, but it happens twice, because this is x minus 1 squared, right? So we have one root multiplicity 2. How many eigenvectors do we have? We have definitely one eigenvector, which is just the first vector in the basis. And there is no more. Check. What we see here is a simplest example of what is called a Chardin block. In general, any operator is a direct sum of Chardin blocks. What is in general Chardin block? As for matrices, a matrix of Chardin block with eigenvalue lambda looks like that. You have to take lambdas on the diagonal, just everywhere lambdas. Below diagonal you have zeros. And above diagonal in the next line you have ones. And above zero. So this is Chardin block corresponding to eigenvalue lambda. This matrix determines an operator. The operator has characteristic polynomial. Equals x minus lambda to power n, where n is the size of this matrix. So it has one, geometrically one root, but it is a root of multiplicity n. And there is only one eigen, well, in this space, we can consider, of course, this lambda t eigenspace, but this eigenspace is one dimensional. So we have to figure out how can it happen and how we can enlarge this eigenspaces to make really to take into account the Chardin blocks. But okay, so for any lambda and any operator, we will consider generalized eigenspace, G lambda T, generalized eigenspace, which corresponds to lambda. What is this? It is the union of null spaces of operators like that, t minus lambda I to power n, and I do not care, all natural numbers. But, used to denote by n the dimension, okay, let it be m. That union of null spaces. As a matter of fact, these null spaces are contained into each other. This is a growing system of spaces, and we will need some technical theorem about this situation. So for a moment, let us consider whatever operator A. this, I switch from T, okay, maybe I will switch to S, not that far away. Let us consider S, an operator in the same situation. We have a vector space, finite dimensional vector space. Okay, let it be of dimension n. At this point, it doesn't matter if the ground field is algebraically closed or not. It doesn't matter here. Later on, S will be T minus lambda I with different lambdas. That's why I switched from T to S. But now let us consider the following spaces. The first in my sequence will be just zero subspace. The second will be null space of S. Of course, zero is contained there. Zero is everywhere. Then I take null space of S squared. And look, this new space contains the second one, null space of S. So when we take powers of S, the null spaces increase. So they cannot increase to infinity. I have only n dimensions here. So I can have at most n times increase of this. Let me explain in detail why this is so. So if we take a vector u from null space of S to power k, then u will belong to the null space of S k plus one and all others. So this is, I'm going to prove that really we have here all these inclusions. And this is obvious. What does it mean that u belongs to the null space of S to power k? It means that S to power k u equals zero. Now apply to both sides S. And you'll see that you have sk plus one of u. And this is S of zero, which is zero. And this is the same as to say that u belongs to null space of S to power k plus one. So really we have an increasing sequence of subspaces. And again, since the dimension is finite, at some point it will stop. But I want to tell you a little bit more about how it will stop. As soon as it stops, it will never go up. In other words, if null S to power m equals null space of S to power m plus one, then for any positive k, null space of S to power m plus k is contained in the null space of S to power m plus k plus one. And this is also obvious. Let me tell you why. So I have to prove. Sorry. I thought about one thing and wrote another. As soon as we will have equality here, we will have equality there, right? This is what I want to prove. I formulated this several times. So stabilization happens at some point. If it happened already, it will never grow again, this null spaces. Okay. So to prove that something is, some sets are equal, it is enough to prove two inclusions. We know already this inclusion. So I have to prove that inclusion. So let me take some element from that U belonging to null space of S to power M plus K plus one. What does it mean? It means that S to power M plus K plus one of U equals zero. Now, I can represent this as follows. It is S to power M of U, no, M plus one. And K S to power K applied to it, right? So I have now some wait. No, 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 vice versa. S to power M plus one of SK of U. I want to rewrite this in this way. So this means that that SK U belongs to that null space. But if it belongs to that space, it belongs also to that space, according to our assumption. So it follows that SM of SK of U equals zero. And this means that S to power K of U, that, sorry, that U belongs to that space, null space of M to power K, M plus one, sorry, S to power M plus K. And we are done. Questions?
Hi, it's Michael Bailey. I work with Jeremiah for Speech and Language. Hi, how are you? I'm trying to follow up because I called last week.
Which part of this doesn't work if they don't stop increasing?
Well, this part is not about stopping increasing. It is just that if it stops at some moment, then never goes up again. Of course, it stops somewhere. And the point where it stops, of course, cannot be later than nth power. It may happen that all of them up to power n will be different. Let me show an example. Let us consider an operator which is upper triangular, but of this very specific kind. So zeros on the diagonal, ones on the next diagonal, and then everywhere else is zero. Okay. So this is my S. The null space of this S is just the first vector. Then S squared annihilates already not only first vector, but also the second one. Sorry, should be span here, span of E1. And here it is span of E1 and E2. And so on. Each time when you raise this to power, you will get greater dimension up to n, or n minus 1. So it's just like that. This is a crucial example and a definition related to it. An operator S is called nilpotent. If there exists some number k such that S to power k equals zero. This is an nilpotent operator. In fact, if you multiply it by itself, take the square of it, you will see something like that, zero, zero, so zeros on the diagonal. And here also will be zeros, but on the next, it will be two. And it will, each time when you multiply this by S, the non-trivial line will be pushed above and above until it will finish, until it will, zeros will occupy the whole space. Check. Okay. So we have this null spaces of operator, which form an increasing sequence. This is equal. So you may start with zeroth power, which is, for which the null space is just zero. So the dimension will increase to some point, and then it will stabilize. Consider now ranges. Range of S naught is just the whole space. Range of S in general may be smaller. And then we have a range of S squared, which also will smaller in general, maybe equal. So we have a decreasing sequence of spaces. For any power, the dimension of null space plus the dimension of range is the dimension of the whole space. We had some time ago this equality at the very beginning of this course. Usually these spaces intersect, but at the moment when they stabilize, and the stable moment, we get that null space of Sn and the range of the same Sn is a direct sum decomposition of the whole space. This is a theorem. Quite often it is formulated in the following way. For this N capital, we just take the dimension of the space, when for sure this sequence will stabilize. So how to prove that? The major lemma for that is that the intersection of these two spaces is zero. Just zero space. From this, it follows immediately this theorem, because we have, we may consider the sum, not necessarily direct, of these two subspaces, null space and range. The dimension of the sum is equal to the sum of dimensions minus dimension of the intersection. If the intersection is trivial, then the sum of these two subspaces must be V. Okay, let me say it in another way. So proof of a theorem. I deduce it from lemma. I will prove lemma later. So let us consider the dimension of the sum. Let me denote this by N and this by R, just to avoid writing long things. So I just consider N plus R. This dimension is dimension of N plus dimension of R minus dimension of the intersection, N intersected with R. By lemma, which I will prove, this is zero. By general formula, this is null space and range of the same operator. This is the dimension of the whole space. And we see that the dimension of the subspace of V is equal to the dimension of V. So it follows that N plus R equals V. and we are done. Then this is direct sum. So instead of proving that any vector of V can be presented as the sum of vectors from the subspaces, I just prove the identity that the dimension of the subspace is equal to the dimension of V. Now I have to do the hard job. I have to prove this lemma. And it is not also a difficult thing to do. Let us consider any vector U which belongs to the intersection N and R. So since it belongs to the null space, it means that S to power N of U equals zero. Since U belongs to R, it means that there exists some vector W from our space such that S to power N of W equals U. Now let us plug in the last identity to here. So we have S to N of S to N W, and this is equal to zero. I just plugged in instead of U this expression. But we know that, so this means that W belongs to null space of S to power to N. But this space is the same as it happened already after stabilization, belongs also to null space of Sn. And therefore, S to power N of W equals zero, but this is U. So I started with U. I used these two assumptions here and there. I manipulated with them and deduced that then U equals zero. And this is what I had to do. Questions?
Is this true even if V is infinite dimensional?
Oh. No, of course, with infinite dimensional situation, first of all, there is no point to have stabilization. The kernel may erase and erase. You may take, for example, this shift operator that we discussed. Shift which moves all the coordinates to the left. Say if you have x1, etc., xn, etc., to infinity, this operator just moves it to x2, x3, and so on. So it shifts everything to the left. Then the null space just of this operator is one-dimensional. It starts with x1 and then all the rest are zero. This is null space, the whole null space for that shift operator. And if you take its square, it will be two-dimensional. If you take cube, it will be three-dimensional. So the number of non-trivial coordinates will increase when you take null space of powers. And it will never happen, finish. Similarly, with the range. Okay, what about range here in this example? Oh, but range here will be all the time the whole space. No. So Nothing like that. I cannot imagine any statement which is not crashed by this example. It's quite a good example. So again, the sequence of null spaces is increasing unboundedly, and the sequence of ranges does not change. Each time it is surjective for any power.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Now, I can go ahead to the structure of arbitrary operator in finite dimensional space. Well, over algebraically closed field, because I will use the assumption that there is this characteristic polynomial has all roots. It factorizes to binomials. It factorizes into binomials. Okay. First of all, okay, let us take arbitrary operator. My finite dimensional space over algebraically closed field. I consider the characteristic polynomial of this operator. And I assume that the dimension of V as always is n. And let lambda 1, etc., lambda m be pairwise different roots, all the roots. So that high t of t is t minus lambda 1 to some power n 1, etc. T minus lambda m to some power n m. Okay? Then lambda 1 is an eigenvalue. And let us consider an operator S, which is T minus lambda 1 I. I take the sequence of, I will decompose the whole space V into direct sum of null space of s to power n and the range of s to power n. We just have seen that there is this decomposition into direct sum of two spaces. Now, these spaces are T invariant. Why they are T invariant? There are two general statements which are close to each other. Consider them as lemmas for any polynomial G. The null space of G of T is invariant, and the range of G of T is T invariant. So both of them are T invariants. Well, for the first case, let us take U from the null space of G of T. This means that G of T of U equals zero. Now, what about T of U? Well, let us consider G of T of T of U. Since T and G of T commute, I can write it as G as T of G of T of U. And this is zero. So that is zero as well. So I proved that the image T of U, the image of U under T, belongs to the same space. G of T applied to T of U is zero. This is the first statement. And similarly, you can prove the second one. If we have some U, which is G of T of W, so U belongs to this range, what about T of U? Would it belong to this range? Write down that T of U is T of G of T of W and change the order. So G of T of T times T of W. And you see that this is the image under G of T of the vector T of W. So this means that this belongs to the range of G of T. So I prove that the range is invariant. I pick up any element from the range, any vector, applied to it T, and proved that the image belongs to the range, presented in this way. The questions? S here is a polynomial of T. S to power n also is a polynomial of T. So the range and null space are invariant, and we have a direct sum decomposition of V into two subspaces which are invariant under T. And now I will deal with this part, and this part is a space where my operator is important. I want to understand the structure of it. As for the rest of the space V of the second summon, there is no eigenvalue lambda 1 over there. Other eigenvalues will be there, but all eigenvalues, eigenvectors belonging to lambda 1 are here. So I had split in this way from my space the part which corresponds to lambda 1. In fact, this null space is nothing but a generalized eigenspace of T correspondent to lambda 1. And this range of S of T, S to power n, is just the sum of all other spaces like that, and we can run this proof by induction just by the number of pairwise distinct roots of our polynomial. Now let me explain how my operator is organized in this null space. First of all, in this G lambda 1 t, I have a part, necessarily non-zero part, which is not generalized but usual eigenspace. So there are eigenvectors. Well, the restriction of T to this subspace must have eigenvector, we know this, and they form this space. So this is a space of non-zero dimension. And we can start with making bases there. However, I want to postpone this. I want to postpone this in the following way. So let's consider, this is an invariant space, this eigenspace for T. And I can consider this G lambda 1 T factorized by this invariant subspace. We can consider the quotient. In this quotient space, I have operator induced by T. T, the quotient operator. Its characteristic polynomial is really a factor of the old characteristic polynomial. So it has only one only one root with some multiplicity. And therefore, I can find in this space eigenspace of lambda 1. Its own eigenspace, but now it is not of T, but of this quotient operator. And then I continue in the same way. So what we have here, we have this E of lambda 1 T in the space, which is mapped by this S. So T minus lambda 1 I to 0. Now there is a quotient, the rest of the space here. This is this one. So the whole space is this plus that, but plus in, so it is not invariant under T. The second part, this part, is not invariant under T. Some part of it goes down to here. And I have here the eigenspace. By operator S, it goes injectively to here. And I can make the quotient. I can take here eigenspace, and it would go here injectively, and so on and so forth. So when I will finish this process, when I will be at the situation when there is nothing above, I can choose basis here. And then drop it here by that operator S and drop there by operator S and drop there by operator S. So I will get a part of basis of the whole space on which my operator behaves in this nilpotent way. So each element of this base goes by S one step below until it goes to the bottom and then to zero. And for each such sequence, I have Jordan block. The highest of them. Then I have to take the next floor here, choose basis, which does not come from there, just complement this basis somehow, and take the same stuff, and I will get here new Jordan blocks, which are of lower height, of lower dimension, and so on and so forth. And after all, I have here few eigenvectors which cannot extend anymore. So I will split this generalized eigenspace into the sum of Jordan blocks of different sizes, but with the same eigenvalues. So the whole architecture will be like that. The whole operator will be split into blocks. In each block, we will have another splitting into blocks, and those blocks will be of different size. Each of them will be Jordan block, belonging here to lambda one, here to lambda two, here to lambda three, and so on. So this is a general picture, and most general operator over algebraically closed field looks like that. Can be reduced into this form. And I feel that my time is about to be finished. So I would ask you to think this through and ask your questions next week when we will meet.
Will we go over this more detailed next week?
Yes, I want to come back to this, but I want you to be ready for discussion. So try to think through, and then I will fill the gaps. There were not much gaps, but probably some of this should be pronounced again, as I did today for the material of the preceding lecture. You know, there is this genre, rondo, in music. In education also it is useful when you repeat the same thing, slightly different. And I will give you also home task, which will refer to things here. Any questions? Yeah, I made a film today, so I will put it on my, at least on my web page. I'm not sure if it will fit. On the Blackboard it will be a reference to it. More questions? If not, let me stop here.